All right, thanks for coming today. We are working through the series on the life of David, talking about who he was and what we can learn from him. And we're going to be spending time in 1 Samuel chapter 18. You know, one of the things people regularly ask me as a pastor is, how can you trust the Bible? Isn't it just a book about God and how great he is and, you know, all of his supernatural work and all these amazing, better, you know, people that you just can't believe how good and amazing they were? And one of the things I tell people is, if you've ever read the Bible, nothing could be further from the truth. I think one of the greatest credibilities that the Bible has is that it does nothing to hide the nitty-gritty challenges of life. And I think one of the things you'll find today as we work through this chapter is, you know, we all know that life is full of good, bad, and the ugly. And one of the things you're going to see very clearly in this chapter as we work through these 16 of these verses in chapter 18 is that we come very, very, you know, we come face to face with the good in people, the bad in people, and the ugliness of life and how it shapes what we all understand that makes life so challenging. So I'm going to work through these 16 verses and spend a little time talking about the three characters in here and the good, bad, and ugly of life. So last week, you got to hear all about David and Goliath, one of the most often told stories of the Bible, and Dan did a great job looking at it from a little different angle. And chapter 18 starts off right on the heels of that, and we're introduced to this person, Jonathan. And apparently what's happening here, it tells us in verse 1, is that David is talking to Saul, and as Jonathan, and Jonathan is the son of Saul, who's the king of Israel, as he hears David talking to Saul, he hears something that he values dearly about this person, David. And the Bible tells us that he becomes one in spirit with him. And what the heck does that mean? Well, the Hebrew in there is kind of interesting. The idea of it is really, it's the idea that he becomes committed to this guy. He recognizes that there's something valuable and good about what this guy is all about and what he stands for, and he wants to be a part of it, and he commits himself to being a part of what David is investing in. Now, after this great victory, it happens in the Valley of Elah, which is right on the border of where the Philistines live and where the nation of Israel is. And so, naturally, the people are on their way back home, and it turns into a victory parade. And as they are on their way home, the women in particular, it says, come out, and they've got tambourines, and they're singing this song of praise to David and Saul. And you have to understand how, you know, why this is such a big deal. You think about the, you know, war and the spoils of war, and so if one side is victorious, you know, they get, they get to take the weapons and the material things that the other people own, they become theirs. Well, back then, the material things that became the other people's were the people. The people were the spoils of war. If you won a victory over another group of people, they became your people. So why would the women come out and celebrate? Well, they come out because they're thrilled because they get their lives. They get to keep their children, their husbands, their homes, their house, their freedom. You know what I mean? This is a huge deal to them, and they are celebrating. They recognize the threat that the Philistines, you know, pose them as a people, and they are thrilled to have their lives. And so they sing this song, and Saul, he's killed lots of people. David, he's killed even more. And in it, you might, you know, there's a sense in which you might go, well, gosh, isn't that kind of degrading to Saul that even though Saul's a good guy, doesn't this lift up David as a better guy? And one of the things you have to know about Hebrew poetry is that wasn't their intent at all. Their intent is, there's a crescendo language in their poetry. You read this in the Bible and other places where it says, there were angels, thousands, thousands upon thousands, 10,000s. What does that mean? Was there thousands? Was there thousands of thousands, or was there 10,000? It's a language of saying crescendo, building, and that's all that they were doing here. And David comes in second because Saul has always been with them, and they're just now recognizing this victory of this guy, David, that he has brought to them. It's in no way meant to be demeaning to Saul. It's poetry. Well, Saul hears this song, and what happens to Saul? He resents it. He doesn't get the poetry. He doesn't like the language used there. And he says, well, what's this all about? I've killed lots of people, but he's killed tens of thousands. Now, not only does Saul not understand the subtleties of poetry here, but there's something else going on here. The guy is clearly blinded by fear of David and the possible threat to his kingdom that David poses. Now, you understand how illogical this is, because Saul, even though he's been a valiant warrior, conquered lots of people, been valiant on the battlefield. Back then, the kings went out and fought right alongside the warriors. He's killed lots of people. He hasn't killed thousands and thousands of people. This is dramatic language, and he doesn't get that. He's so angry, and he's so nervous. He's so afraid of what's going on here. He's so suspicious that as soon as he hears this, all he can think of is the threat that David poses to him. And what does he say? What more can this guy get but the kingdom? They arrive at home, and it says, the next day, an evil spirit from God took control of Saul, and he began to rave. And that word rave, some of your Bibles, most Bibles say prophesy, because what was happening is there was something inside of him that was speaking truth. But it's obviously not good stuff, and everybody who hears him thinks the guy is a raving lunatic. And David is there, you know, and Saul gets in these angry moods. David's got his little harp, and he's playing his harp, trying to calm Saul down. David's got his harp, Saul's got his spear, and Saul chucks the spear at David, not once, but twice. He's so angry, trying to get rid of this guy. And this is kind of a covert, this is his first opportunity, he thinks, to get rid of somebody who is a threat to his kingdom. Now, the Bible in this chapter is really trying to draw a contrast between people. So you learn in verses 14, 15, and 16, you get this picture of David. David, everything he did, man, he was successful at. Saul sees all that success, and he's freaked out, man. The guy is scared, and he's obviously acting like a lunatic. And verse 16 tells us that, you know what? All of the people, in fact, as you read along in here, you find out that Saul's son, we've already found out about, but Saul's daughter, all of Saul's servants, and even all of his warriors, everybody is enamored with David. Everybody loves this guy. Everybody sees what a blessing he is to the people. Everybody is super impressed with him. So the Bible is trying to contrast these people and their behavior. If you have your notes, you can pull them out and work through a couple of fill-in-the-blanks here. So what I want to do this morning is I just want to talk about these three people in here. I'll start with David and actually spend very little time on David because it's pretty clear what he's all about here. And I think a way to think about this is if David represents for us sort of the secret to success in life. And the reason David is successful, and the scripture is very clear about this, what brings success in David's life is how he sees himself. David saw himself as a servant of God. And it plays out wherever he was in life. Think about this. When David was a shepherd was someone who protected the wealth of the family. Back then, the way you had money, the biggest material benefit you had was land and animals. That's how you knew you were rich. David's what? He's entrusted with a job, and it's not a pretty job. It's not a job that any of the other brothers wanted, right? We remember that from a couple weeks ago. David's job is to go out and take good care of the animals out there, and apparently he did it well. In fact, his family valued him so much that they, even after he gets promoted, they ask him to come back, to go back to that job again. And notice that David, even after he leaves being a shepherd to go serve with Saul, and his family calls him back home, where does he go back to? To being a shepherd. I serve the king, and I'm even willing to go back home and serve my family. That's what he was doing. He was helping protect the family's wealth. When he's out in the battlefield, he always fought right alongside his friends, even though he was their commander, and he was highly esteemed by all of the other people he fought with because he was right in the middle of the trenches with all of them. And then he served Saul, and understand this about serving Saul. You know, sometimes we get good jobs where we have a great boss who we look up to, who's a man of integrity, you know, protects our best interest. And man, it's easy to serve those kind of people, isn't it? It's easy to work hard for them. Saul was not that kind of boss. Saul's the kind of boss that was trying to kill you all the time. All the time. And David never shies away from protecting Saul, looking to Saul's best interest, even though Saul wanted to kill the guy. David never for a minute tried to escape the pressure of serving Saul and doing it well. He went and did whatever Saul asked him to do, and he did it well, even when it was his neck on the line. Saul wants him to marry his daughter. And the reason Saul wants him to marry his daughter, because he knows it's an opportunity for the enemy to want to kill his son-in-law. That's Saul's only idea about, you know, he's not happy for David, doesn't want him to marry into the family. He thinks this is an opportunity for my enemies to come after him. And he says, well, the price of that is going to be 100 Philistine foreskins. And David, you know, he can't deny what Saul wants him to do. Well, what's the idea behind going and getting foreskins from your enemies? What's Saul hoping is going to happen here? Saul's hoping that this is David's end. And what does David do? He says, all right, I'll bring back 200. Whatever he did, even in serving Saul, even when he had the opportunity to knock Saul off, and people encouraged him to do it. They said, this guy's nuts, get rid of him. David never does it. See, because David's primary identity in life was, I am God's person. Wherever he puts me, and I'll serve and do him the best I can. And so what you see in this is, as a result of that, the Bible makes this thing about, the Bible's going to tell us about what that person is like. And it says, God was with David because of this. Now, I want to stop right here because there's a little bit of danger in what I just did. I said, hey, if you want success in your life, here's the recipe. You know, put this together, cook it up, and everything is going to go good for you. And there's a little bit of danger in telling you that this is a recipe for success. Because what you find is, although whatever David did, he did well and found success in, did that mean that everything went well for David? Anybody who's read the Bible knows, no way. David's life is one challenge. How are you doing, Scott? Good to see you. You know, David's life is one challenge after another, isn't it? Just because he's blessed by God and just because he finds success in what he does doesn't mean life is going to be, you know, a garden of roses. So in no way am I saying that just because you have success in what you do means that your life is going to be easy. Don't make that equation. That would be a very dangerous one to make. So David, primary identity, I'm a servant, wherever God puts me. Okay, and then we get this contrast with Saul, who is the king. And if you want to look at Saul's life in this passage, it's a recipe for how to destroy yourself. And so Saul's first big mistake that he makes in here is Saul's way of seeing himself. David saw himself as a servant. Saul saw himself as what? The king. And everything he did, his every motive in his life, every decision was built around what? Protecting his power and authority. Here's the crazy thing about this. Saul loves being king. That's who he wants to be, and he loves all the things that come with it. Here's the crazy thing about this. The more he tries to hold on to that position in life, notice the less kingly he becomes in nature and attitude. Rather than using any of what his power is about to help, benefit, bless, serve, that stuff all goes out the window as he starts to hoard and tries to hold on to that self-identity. How you see yourself so often dictates how you live your life. I don't think this is a mystery to anybody in here. Think about this from the perspective of a professional athlete. A professional athlete's, you know, their whole life is built around becoming great at something. So they organize their time, their diet, their relationships. You know, they'll sacrifice relationships, even their family sometimes, to become great at a sport. And how many of you have ever seen this? There's a million examples of this, but how many have ever seen this? A professional athlete goes out on top. Best of the best, world champion, whatever, top of the game. And they go out and they can't stay away. They have to do what? They have to come back. And why is that? Why do they feel necessary to come back? They proved themselves. They showed everybody that they were the best. Why do they feel like they have to come back? Well, I don't think it's a mystery, because when you build your whole life on something and all of the choices that you make are towards that one end, when you stop doing that, what do you have to go back to? Nothing. Unless you've got something else to go back to that is important or of value in your life, what do you have in life? Nothing. It's no wonder these people so often have to go back, because their self-worth, their self-identity, everything is wrapped up in making themselves who they are. And it can be subtly dangerous even just in our own lives if we're not careful. I don't know any of you that are, you know, top-of-the-game professional athletes, so probably most of you are going, oh, if I dodge that bullet, I don't have to worry about that. But, you know, let's say you're a parent. I do this in my own life. I've got three boys and a little baby girl, and I've got this picture up in my office of my son Levi, and it's when he was about 4 years old, and it's this picture where his posture is a posture that Levi always had as a young child. He's kind of he's standing on the front porch. And he's got his head kind of like this, and his body is like that. I mean, if you saw the picture, you'd see what I'm talking about. And it was just sort of the way Levi, it's the way he was. And I have so many fond memories of Levi when he was young. You know, from the time Levi was 3 years old, he would go salmon fishing with me on my boat. And man, the kid could be out on the water for 4 hours, never complained, loved being out there. You know, we'd ride on the skateboard. I'd come home from work because I live right next door to the church, and I'd come home from church. And you know, my other kids are infants at this time, and Levi and I had this really special bond. And so he and I would get on the skateboard, and you know, he'd kneel on the front, and we'd skateboard down a couple blocks down to 7-Eleven and get a slushie and sit down there and talk and play tic-tac-toe in the dirt. And I mean, I had this affinity with my son Levi, you know, from the time he was about 2.5, 3 years old up to the time he was about 6, where the other kids were, you know, his brothers were infants or really small. He and I just had a blast. We were just, he was my little buddy. And I have said on more than one occasion, as my son, who's not my little buddy anymore, he's my big buddy. Next, you know, he is 11 years old and he's up to here, which most of you aren't surprised about because I'm short. All of you are taller than me too. But he's, you know, next year he's going to be taller than me. And I've said to him on more than one occasion, I miss my little Levi. And I'll come up to him, I'll put my hands on his shoulder, and I'll push him down. Push. So he knows, you know. What's that all about? It's about, I look back at a time that was really fond in my life with my son. That was I really cherish. And see, here's the danger, though. Levi's going to keep getting older, isn't he? There may even be a day where Levi will want to leave the house. Or maybe even get married. Get a job, go somewhere else. And see, because I love my kids, it's hard for me to think about them growing up, becoming independent, and doing their own thing. What child doesn't want to grow up, become independent, do their own thing, become the person that God wants them to be? But see, as parents, and I've seen this so many times, and like I said, I even make the mistake, you know, without even thinking about it, of saying, I miss my little buddy. And you know what I've seen happen time and time again as a youth pastor? Parents that because of their own intrinsic value of they love their kids, and it's they love their kids, they want what's best for them, but because they value them so much, they want to hold on to them, and when good opportunities come along, they go, well, I guess you could do that. And what's really at the heart of that? They don't really want necessarily what's best for the other person. What are they looking at? What's best for them? They see themselves as parents. I just had a really honest discussion with someone after church that said to me, you know what? They have an only child who's getting ready to do this. And I said, man, I know what you mean. This is who I am. It's part of who we are. And it's hard for me to want the best, even though I know this is the good thing for them. So easy, even as parents, to fall in this trap, to see ourselves, make our primary identity something other than as a child of God or as a servant of His. And check this out. How many of you have ever seen that people who might do that with their children, because they hold on, end up destroying a relationship with their child? Because they so smother or stifle that the very thing that they love, they hold on to, they destroy. What does Saul end up doing in the story? The very thing he loves, the very thing he cherishes, the very thing he wants most in life, he totally destroys. The second thing you see in Saul, and this is really at the crux of this whole thing, is envy. Saul cannot embrace the good thing that God's doing through David. He can't celebrate it. And even though it's not just beneficial for him as a king and for his people beyond him, he's so envious of David that all he wants to do is get rid of him. Saul, 6-7 times, depending on how you count it, 7 totally separate incidents, tries to kill David. And here's the thing about this. You can see how this works, how it gets worse and worse and worse in his life. The first three times he tries to kill David, it's covert. It's sort of like the situation with the spear. Not many people around. There aren't witnesses. He's trying to get rid of him. At the end, he's so ticked. He's so furious. He's so angry, so afraid, so paranoid about David that, man, he doesn't care who knows. He just wants the guy dead. And say, that's the power of unchecked envy in our life. We can't celebrate good in other people's lives. And I think that there's part of why envy is so dangerous is this, is first of all, if I asked you at the beginning of the service, I said, take out your notes, write on the back, and I just want you to write the top five things that are struggles for you in your life. You know, you might write lust, or you know, you maybe suffer from bouts of, you know, anger, you know, jealous sometimes. You'd write down a list of whatever five things. I'd be surprised if there's anybody in here that wrote down envy, and I'll tell you why. Because envy is so hard to identify, because at the root of envy is pride. You think life is about you. And if you're focused on you and you're in the midst of envy because you think it's about you, it's very difficult for you to be self-aware enough to go, you know what, I recognize why I'm in the midst of this destructive behavior. Because pride is what's behind it, underneath it, I think. So it's difficult to identify in our lives. And I think the other reason envy is so hard to be honest about in our own lives is there isn't anybody that wants to be envious. Because we all know, when you start talking about envy, you know that envy hurts. It's painful. And so when you think of the other list of sins, let's say lust or gluttony, for example, you know, I don't know very many people that, you know, guys that would say lust isn't pleasurable for a time. It may kill me and destroy my life in the end, but there's something pleasurable about it that we're drawn to. Gluttony, more, you know. There's something pleasurable about it for a time, even if we know in the end it will be unhealthy for us. Now, envy isn't like that. People don't look at envy and go, oh, gee, I'd like to fall into envy for a little while. You know what I mean? That's not our disposition about it. So I think that there's this hidden sense in which we don't value it. It's hard to recognize in our life, and therefore we sort of keep it at arm's length. But check this out. Envy is among the most destructive of all the issues that we can harbor in our life, of all the sins. It's listed as one of the seven deadly sins, obviously. And let me just take you on a 30-second tour of the Bible. Let's see, Satan at the beginning. What led to Satan's fall, his demise? Oh, pride. Why? It was what? He was envious of the glory that was God's. He wanted it for himself. Adam and Eve in the garden. You could say deception was at the beginning of that, but tell me this is not part of what's going on there in that deception, where Satan says to Adam and Eve, God's holding out on you. And what do they want? They want something God has that they think he's holding out on them. Joseph, before we go to Joseph, let's just go Cain and Abel. What's that story about? Oh, right? I mean, you see in all of these stories, some of the biggest stories of the Bible, Joseph, why did his brothers hate him? He was the youngest of them. It's because dad somehow favored him and gave him a special coat. You know, they didn't want the rainbow coat. That's not what they were after. They were jealous that dad liked the kid. That's why all the brothers were bent on getting rid of Joseph. The story of Esther that we love, Haman, he's a successful guy. He's got everything coming to him. He's getting promoted through the chain. And what's the one thing in his life? He can't stand Mordecai. And it's not even that Mordecai is doing anything good. He just can't stand that the guy's alive. And all of that envy that he has towards him is what destroys him in the end. And you can go on and on and on. Think about this. How many of you know and love the story of the prodigal son in the Bible? What's the older brother's problem? The son comes home. They're having a party. Who doesn't want a party? He doesn't want a party. Why not? Because it wasn't a party for him. He can't enjoy that his brother's home. He's envious that his brother's getting something that he thinks he deserves. It's all about him. He can't celebrate. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Amadeus. It does a great job of portraying this, although it's a little bit fictitious. But Salieri, who is the teacher of Amadeus, and the movie portrays him as a pious man, writes music for God, you know, sees his vocation and his life as an offering to God. And the guy, you know, he was, even at his time, he was actually kind of a celebrated guy, but later on became somewhat kind of mediocre in terms of the value of his music. Well, his He has a student, a prize student, Amadeus, who is, he's not as pious. You know what I mean? The guy's got some serious vices in his life, and and Salieri doesn't see him as a hard worker or dedicated to God, and he doesn't like him. And worse than that, he's envious of this guy's gift. He just can't fathom it. At the end of his life, I love the way the movie portrays it. He says, 32 years of torture I endured, and it's all God's fault. What's it all about in his eyes? Me. I did something good for God. God owes me. Why can't he celebrate the success of somebody else? Because he thinks he deserves the success. And it puts this fog that he sees the world in. It makes it so he's not able to see reality. He's not able to celebrate what everybody else, what's plain to everybody else. That's what envy will do to you. It will distort your judgment. It will distort your ability to see the world as everybody else sees it, and you certainly won't see the world as God does. Now, this is all important because what? The Bible's contrasting Saul and David, and so Saul, David through his actions, God is with him, and we find out in all of these things that what? The bad news for Saul is that God was against him in all of this. Now, there's sort of this contrast between David and Saul, and that's sort of what most of us would focus on. But there's actually a bigger contrast in this whole story that is bigger than the contrast between David and Saul. Some people say, you talk about father and son, and so Jonathan is Saul's son. And so people will say, like father, like son. Or people will say, talking about how our traits sometimes are not dissimilar from our parents. And you might say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I titled this message, Sometimes the Apple Does Fall Far from the Tree, because that is the case here. The real contrast in this story is not David and Saul. The big contrast in this story is Saul and his son Jonathan, who could not be more different in their actions, attitude, and heart about this whole story. And Jonathan is, for us, the picture of how to protect yourself from allowing envy, pride, jealousy to get a foothold in your life. And the first thing you have to understand about Jonathan is, Jonathan had it coming to him. Saul was his dad. Remember I told you that Saul throws a spear at David because he wants to eliminate him? Saul gets so angry at his son Jonathan that Saul, at one point, I think it's in chapter 22, tries to kill Jonathan. Why would a dad be so angry with him? The reason that Saul is so angry with his son Jonathan is because Saul says, David, threat to the kingdom today. And he says, Jonathan, do you see David is a threat to the kingdom for you tomorrow? And Jonathan, Saul, wants the kingdom so bad, wants it for his son so bad, he's so angry that his son doesn't get it, he wants to kill his own son. Because Jonathan is willing to lay aside all of the power, all of the prestige, all of the glory that came from being king and was willing to give it to somebody else who, in some sense, from an earthly perspective, didn't deserve it because David was not a part of the family. And that's how kings were passed down. And Jonathan was willing to forfeit his title, his privilege, his prestige, everything to be able to serve David. Here's the four things in here. The first one is real love for someone else desires the best for them. Twice in this story, Jonathan says that that he loved David as himself. Sometimes, there have been people recently, liberal scholars, that say they use this story to say, well, they must have had like a homosexual relationship or something. There must have been something in this that they weren't just friends. And you have to understand the text in no way even hints at that. And certainly historically, there's absolutely zip evidence that that is ever true. Here's the thing about this, and the reason I think that's so degrading to what actually happens here is because this sort of love has nothing to do ultimately with feelings. See, sometimes we think that love is about how we feel about somebody else, but notice that's not what this story tells us. It tells us that Jonathan didn't just want in his heart David to do well, he did everything in his own physical power, using his gifts, talents, and ability to help David succeed. In the same way he would want others to help him to succeed, he invested his life in a practical way to help David do well. Even at his own expense. Even though it would cost him all of the earthly things that most people crave and desire in life, he genuinely wanted what was best for somebody else, and he was able to celebrate what God was doing in David. The second thing is, Jonathan reminds us to be satisfied in life, right, where God places you. Who doesn't want to be promoted? Anybody say, demote me? You know, we all want promotion. We all want to be recognized for our hard work. There ain't anybody that doesn't. Jonathan is willing to step back and help promote David to the place that was his, you know, according to heir and title. And he was able to step back and say, I will play second fiddle here. Because this is what's going on here really isn't about me. Paul, in that great story, you know, Philippians, talking about his life, looking back at all the hardships and trouble he's been through. He's been naked and, you know, lacked provisions and food and everything. And he also recognized there's times where he's had plenty. And what is Paul saying all that? He says, you know, whatever the circumstance, wherever God places me, I'm his, and I've learned to be content right where God's placed me. You know, when I moved up here to work on staff here and be one of the pastors here, you know, to be the third teaching pastor, in a sense, you know, I could have, there's a sense of which I could have come and said, I now am one of the pastors here. I will teach you. You shall listen to me. You know, I could have come and felt like I was somehow, because of the title behind my name, that I was, you know, you owed some sort of respect or some sort of authority ultimately is given to me. And, you know, fortunately, I think I was smart enough to recognize that that didn't have anything to do with what I'm doing here. You know, Dan and John have been here forever. My job ultimately when I came up here, from my perspective, was to work hard to make Dan and John successful in what they were already doing. That was sort of my, you know, what I came here to do. Is to help them succeed in what they were already doing well. And I've heard people say, and there's a sense in which I think, yeah, that's probably what will happen. You know, that as years go by, I'll become more gifted in my ability to lead, teach, do all the things that a pastor does. I'll become better at those things. And someday Dan and John will retire and I will, you know, I will be sort of I will serve the place that they did. And I think there's a sense in which, you know, that may happen. And that's sort of the natural progress of things. But you know what? What if that isn't what God wants to have happen here? What if after Dan and John are gone, somebody else more gifted than me comes in? See, I have no idea what God's plans are for me. I went and got blood work done this last week, and I might find out that I'm dying next week. You know what I mean? I have no idea. And even though there's this sort of chain of promotion and the way things work in the world, you know what, man, you better start recognizing that although there is a way of things that way they, things work in the world, that isn't the way God always works. And our focus, our goal has always got to be to say, whatever your will is, Lord, today or tomorrow, allow me to be comfortable to serve you right where you place me. Because the minute you start putting your hopes in your expectations of what you think ought to happen, if it doesn't, what will happen? You will be disappointed. And your hopes are ultimately in your plans, not in God's plans. Yeah, that's what leads to anger, bitterness, and frustration in our life, when we think it's about us. And that's what Jonathan teaches us so well in this passage. You guys remember, this is probably like in 2002 or 3. I've got this little poster in my wall. If you ever come in there, you see it's kind of down low on the cabinet that I have right next to my desk. Joe Bells in World Magazine. He was the publisher at the time. And I was living in Monterey, and I always remember thinking, I'm never going to own a home in Monterey. It just ain't going to happen. But I had this desire, I wanted a home. I wanted to be a homeowner. And Joe Bells had this picture of a bear trap. And in the middle of the bear trap was a home. And he says, the caption to it said, we spend our whole lives trying to get what God has not given You know, I still keep that because I think of that. Don't get your expectations or your hopes or your desires out of line with God's. Allow Him to set the agenda and place you where He's going to place you, and work hard, because otherwise you will step in that trap the minute you start making plans, your plans. Third thing in here, Jonathan, this is kind of weird. Jonathan is not just an example for us how to live, but Jonathan is also a picture of what Jesus will do. See, the throne was, the glory was going to be Jonathan's. And in the beginning, what? Jesus had the glory, the throne with the Father, right? And Jesus gave up His place of glory to come down to become vulnerable, even to death on a cross, vulnerable. Why did He do that? It was God's plan to remedy the problem of sin in the world. What was the problem with sin? Sin is what kept us away from Him. What's at the root of all of that? God's desire for a relationship with us. Why would Jesus give all that up? Because He wants what's best for you. See, Jonathan is kind of this picture of what Jesus will ultimately do for us. Jonathan had the throne, the title, it was rightfully his. And he knew ultimately to get what other people, the blessing for other people in His kingdom, he had to step aside, he had to give it up. The Bible tells us there's kind of this cool picture that God sees us with the righteousness of Jesus. We are in faith His children. We're children of God. And I think if we really believe that, it kind of changes or affects how we act. My boys, when they were in Monterey, they were in karate, and they still keep all their, you know, they've got knight uniforms that they did from this unit that they did on medieval times. And so when they want to battle, what do? They put on their knight's helmets, they put on their armor, and they start doing battle. I came home a couple weeks ago, and Levi, my oldest son, he's got these red karate shorts that only come up to here on him now. But he's still got them on. And he's got his top on, and he's out there wrestling with his brothers and some other kids in the neighborhood. What's that all about? Why are they dressing up to do that? You don't need to dress up to do that. Why do you do it? You dress up because dressing up makes you feel the part, doesn't it, right? I think that's true when we get our hands around how God sees us as His children. When you see yourself the way God does, and you recognize who He is, and you put on the full armor of God, I think that part of that whole thing is when you dress the part, you know the part, you recognize who you are as God's children, it will change the way you act. Last thing in here. Jonathan, this whole bit, did you go back to that first verse, and it's really interesting. Notice what Jonathan does. He gave up his robe. What was the robe all about? The king, when he abdicated his responsibility as king, when he wanted to run away, he'd leave his robe on the throne. Jonathan gives David his robe, he gives him his tunic, he gives him his belt, he gives him his sword. And don't miss this if you go back and read verse 1. Notice what it says. The Hebrew is very intentional about this. The Hebrew says, and Jonathan gave him his, it says, even his sword. What's that all about? If you, as a king, gave someone else your sword, what would happen next to you? Where did that sword end up in ancient times? You would pass over your sword to your servant or to someone else who had defeated you in battle. Why? So they could kill you. Do you see what Jonathan is doing right here? He says, I lay it all. I will become completely vulnerable. And people go, Jonathan must have been a wimp, man. What's this? Was Jonathan chicken? Go back and read chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, and you will see Jonathan was a man's man. This guy was a stud. He single-handedly turned this whole battle, climbs a wall, single-handedly turns this entire battle over because of his bravery. The guy was awesome as a warrior. Awesome, valiant. What does he do? He lays it all aside. For what? Because he recognizes, see, this is so key for us. He recognizes the only way that he's ultimately going to get and benefit from God's blessing in his life is to give his throne over to the anointed one, over to David. He wants to experience the blessing in his life, his friend's life, and the life of his kingdom. Ultimately, he had to get out of the way. I think that's so true of us in our own lives. The only way we can ultimately really experience the blessings that God has for us is to stop making us the center of everything. The only way God will ultimately be glorified in our lives and be a blessing to our friends, to the people we work with, and the town that we live in, is when we're willing to get off the throne and say, Lord, I'm willing, and will make your priorities mine. I will do things your way. I will play second fiddle even if you ask me to, even if I feel like I'm entitled to first fiddle. I'll do go be wherever you want me to be, because I know ultimately that's where I will experience the good and the peace of you ruling in my life that will benefit not only me, but my family, my friends, and other people who come to know me. God bless you guys. I hope that Jonathan stands as an example for you this week as to how to live. If our ushers are come forward, we'll have our offering. Have a great week, guys.
Hey guys, you know how we all have that Jonathan in our lives if we're fortunate? My good friend Marie Hansen is that kind of a Jonathan to me. She has been missing now for over a week and a half. So if you guys think about it, would you please pray for her?